Welcome to another All Souls Forum here on KKFI. This week's program is about reproductive rights, and our featured speaker is Julie Burkhart, who worked for 7 years with Dr. George Tiller in Wichita. She has opened her own clinic, the Southwind Women's Center, in 2013, also in Wichita, and she provides reproductive health care for the area. She has a very interesting and timely topic this week, so we hope you all will learn something and enjoy this featured speaker. This program was recorded on December the 14th of 2014 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. We'll have our usual format today. We'll have the talk from Ms. Burkhart, and then we'll break for a short time, and then we'll come back with questions from the audience. So let us begin.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the forum at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. Almost always we have a speaker from our local community, but this time we have Julie Burkhart, who is coming from Wichita. Now, Kansas has kind of changed the nature of the state quite a bit in recent years as it's become quite a bit more conservative, but many of us associate Wichita with protests dealing with reproductive issues. Anyway, Julie has a clinic in Wichita and is going to be talking a little bit about her clinic, but also more generally how various kinds of reproductive issues, economic issues, and so forth are all involved with each other. So as usual, she'll be speaking, then we'll have a brief pause and take up our collection and go to Q&A. So, Julie?
So I am really honored and pleased to be here today, and I really want to thank Carolyn McDonald for making this happen. I haven't been in this church for quite some time, so it's really nice to be back. Before I get started with my talk, I wanted to share a story. I was reminded of it after this election cycle, and I'm suspecting that a lot of you were disappointed the way I was disappointed, both locally and federally. So I used to work with Dr. George Tiller, and during the after the 2004 election cycle between the presidential with Bush and Kerry, I went into his office a couple days after the election results had come out, and we were meeting and talking, and I started going on and ranting about the election cycle. And finally, I looked over at him, and he was sucking his thumb. And I was like, okay, I stopped, and I was like, why are you sucking your thumb? Could you tell me? And he took his thumb out of his mouth, and he goes, are you done? So I said, I guess I'm done. He goes, good, now it's time to get back to work. So the moral of the story is, no matter how bad things get or they seem, we have to keep pressing on, and that's what we are doing. Yes, so today I was going to talk about abortion rights, contraception, and women's birthing rights as well. So as Unitarians, we all have a deep commitment to social justice, which encompasses reproductive rights, and it is this that I am going to focus on today. So whether one believes in the right or not to abortion, the right or not to contraceptive use, or the right or not for women to birth the way they wish, we must still acknowledge that our society, when people are denied this, people suffer. So this is a thing I want to ask you about today. Do we want our society to base a woman's worth on her pregnancy status? So a couple of months ago, we had a woman come into our clinic, which is Trust Women's Southwind Women's Center in Wichita, and she was incredibly ill due to her pregnancy. She was in her first trimester of pregnancy, about 10 weeks pregnant. Her body was rejecting the pregnancy, and she had one child and had been on bed rest throughout the entire pregnancy. So she'd been through this before. So, long story short, a hospital in Kansas, where she'd been hospitalized due to the illness, refused to provide a first trimester therapeutic abortion. And the reason they did this was fear of retribution by anti-choice folks. So instead, she had to be transported to us, and we were about 90 miles away, where we did her procedure in our clinic, which were an ambulatory surgery center, but not a hospital. And then she was readmitted to a local hospital for further observation after this very simple procedure. This scenario was troubling due to the fact that even though this woman was fraught with illness, the hospital still denied her this first trimester procedure, denying the rights of this woman and her health. By allowing people to determine what is best for their lives, we are acknowledging that there are gray areas where our own personal opinions may not be suited. Entrusting people with complex decision-making is to say to people that their lives matter and that we value their decisions. So today, I want to share with you the ramifications of restrictive laws and the stigma surrounding reproductive health care. I also want to share with you some of the history that Wichita and Kansas carries in the women's rights movement and what we might consider when it comes to pregnancy, whether it's carrying a baby to term or choosing adoption or abortion. The realm of reproductive rights is so much more than abortion. It's so much more than political headlines, sensationalized news headlines, and all the talking points. It's about the worth of a woman and the continuum of her fertility and pregnancy. So I began my career in this field in direct patient care and advocacy at a clinic in Kansas. So in the late 80s, I worked at the Wichita Women's Center when I was back on summer college breaks from Seattle. And it just so happened that I was working at the clinic when anti-choice groups from around the country descended on Wichita for the so-called Summer of Mercy in 1991, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. And even though I was raised in the feminist tradition, this experience was, it further helped to open my eyes, and it further worked to entrench my belief in women's rights and autonomy over their bodies. Wichita has been the epicenter for many fights regarding the women's rights movement due to the fact that our late and beloved Dr. George Tiller provided later termination of pregnancy. And he literally saw women from all over the world. In the office, there was a big world map that we had up, and I think just about every country was covered. He was able to intervene in cases where mothers were deathly ill or where their dearly loved and wanted babies were just not going to survive. And because he did this vital, life-saving work, Wichita became a hotbed of anti-choice activity. So in 1991, protesters descended upon the city en masse. Streets were clogged. Clinics were blockaded by literally thousands of aggressive demonstrators. And for months, Wichita was a national spectacle. Patients and doctors alike were harassed. Eventually, most of these demonstrators picked up and they went back to where they came from. But some stayed and they set up shop and they made it their mission to shut down Dr. Tiller by any means necessary. They harassed him at his clinic, at his church. They harassed clinic employees at their homes and their churches, and they hounded him in the courts time and time again, especially near the time of his death. And they worked in the legislature to ban this constitutionally guaranteed right. During this time, in 1991, I saw women who were heckled, belittled, and threatened by protesters. And women at this time really had to have spines of steel if they wanted to have an abortion. Dr. Tiller, once the owner of one of three clinics in Wichita, was eventually the only provider left. And so he was forever a target. He survived one assassination attempt in 1993, which you might remember. He went back to work the very next day because he said that he was not going to be bullied into submission. But tragically, he didn't survive the second assassination attempt, and as we all know, he was shot and killed in his church on May 31st of 2009. So the shock and the pain of what happened that very sunny Sunday, it really rocked us to the core, and it turned the national spotlight back on Wichita. The why of it all, the echoes of how could this happen, the tears and the candles and the mementos that were left for him, those are things that will never leave me. But the sentiment that I heard that day was, what about the women who are scheduled to see him? What are they going to do, and where are they going to go? I didn't have an answer, nor did anybody else. And you might remember that Mrs. Tiller went ahead and closed the clinic due to his death. So Wichita was without an abortion provider until April of 2013, approximately 4 years after Dr. Tiller's murder. And it was a desperate time, I heard, for women of the area who needed care. And today I'm proud to say that Trust Women's Southwind Women's Center is open and we're seeing patients. We'll mark our 2 years in April. And to date, we've seen around 3,000 patients at our clinic. Dr. Tiller was one of a kind, and I was truly fortunate to have worked with him as the director of his political action committee that he founded. And I carry the words that he spoke so often as the mantra for our young organization, Trust Women. Trust Women was one of his favorite axioms, and it's the centerpiece of the reproductive rights movement. When thinking about legislating reproductive rights, whether contraception, birthing rights, or abortion, the question central to the discussion should be this: does this show trust in the ability and right of a person to make his or her own decision? And unfortunately, far too many pieces of proposed legislation and established laws do not. Another story I'd like to share with you is about a woman who came to see us from western Kansas. She lived just right up close to the Colorado border, so way west. It was a long trek to us. And she was also coming in for an early first trimester procedure, just like the first woman I told you about. And she was firm in her decision to not continue the pregnancy. And however, when she arrived, she realized that she had forgotten her 24-hour consent form for her procedure. And I remember standing at the window, talking with her, tears running down her face, as I told her that we could not see her that day because she forgot her consent form and she could not sign another consent form at the time because she had to wait 24 hours. And it's a document, mind you, that was put in place by our government with the sole intent to block access to reproductive health care. She tearfully left, and she returned the next week for her appointment. The roadblock didn't last long, but it was the woman. She paid the price. She spent more money on transportation. She lost wages at work. And she paid more in child care because she is already a mother. Unfortunately, reproductive health is not a part of a healthy dialogue in this country. Many people simply don't discuss the ramifications of a fetal personhood law or a late-term restriction because they just don't think it's ever going to affect them. No one wants to think that they'll ever be in a difficult situation where difficult decisions must be made. But across the country, people are finding out just how little they're trusted. In many states, women can be arrested while in labor and forced into a C-section if a doctor believes that she needs one. A woman can be denied the morning after pill if a pharmacist has a moral objection to her need for them. Proposed legislation in several states has attempted to grant personhood to human eggs, making it a felony if a woman does certain things during a pregnancy, and even scrutinizing the circumstances of each and every miscarriage, making grieving women the subject of criminal investigations. The universal theme here is clear. There's no trust, and most frightening, the worth and rights of a woman disappear the second she becomes, or even could potentially become, pregnant. In this country, approximately 1 in 3 women will have an abortion in their lifetimes. And 60% of those women who have abortions are already mothers. It's clear when women come into our clinic, they're trying to make the best possible decision for the children they already have. Their decision is made out of compassion and love for their families. If you think about it, women spend, on average, 30 years trying not to get pregnant. And that's a pretty tall order, given that no contraceptive device is perfect. Now, with long-acting reversible contraceptives, such as IUDs and implants, women are better able to control their fertility, but nothing's perfect. As I said before, Trust Women and the pro-choice movement are about more than abortion, but it's important to talk about the realities of abortion to shed light on the real people and stories that make up this gray area of life. When I was working with Dr. Tiller, I would read the letters that patients would send back to him, and literally he had just stacks and stacks of letters and cards that patients and their families had sent back to him, and they were framed and up all over the clinic. And one was from a girl thanking him and expressing her gratitude for being able to go back to the fifth grade. Or the family who was able to go on and have 2 healthy, beautiful children after they lost their first baby. So abortion isn't black or white. There are only shades of gray, and it's in those shades of gray that people are living their lives and making the most difficult and sometimes heartbreaking decisions. The missing element is trust. Do we trust that a family will do what is best for themselves in their own situation? To parent or to choose adoption? To maybe terminate or to deliver a baby that's only going to last for minutes or hours? These are personal decisions that cannot be answered in a calculated, abstract way. These are the gray areas of life where people are just trying to make the best decisions possible. What we don't often realize is the impact that so-called abortion laws have on women and families who are simply trying to bring a wanted child into the world. Fetal personhood laws exist in many states. In most cases, these laws came about because of instances of violence against women that's resulted in the death of the fetus and sometimes also in the death of the woman. These laws don't prevent violence, they punish after the fact. These laws, supposedly meant to punish criminals, are being used to intimidate and prosecute pregnant women. And I wanted to, and I have copies of these, which I can give to you, but on November 7th, 2 colleagues of mine with National Advocates for Pregnant Women, they had a opinion piece in the New York Times called Pregnant and No Civil Rights. And it's this organization that represents pregnant women who have been charged with fetal homicide or child endangerment during their pregnancies. So this is a very good article to read. And then just recently they took on a new case in Wisconsin where a woman who is, she's due to deliver her baby next month, but at 14 weeks of pregnancy was incarcerated because they thought she was endangering her fetus. So those 2 articles are very eye-opening. And across the country, as I was saying, women are being charged with murder after losing a child due to fetal demise or stillbirth, adding gross injury to the deepest of insults. These laws are also used to impose the will of doctors on patients and the morality of a small minority onto the unsuspecting majority. In the United States, birth has become a very medicalized, sterile act, one that takes place typically in a hospital, often with the use of unnecessary labor-inducing medications and interventions, ones that increase the likelihood of C-section deliveries. Additionally, it's prevalent amongst medical professionals to discourage women from even trying to have a vaginal birth after a C-section, which is otherwise known as a VBAC. The World Health Organization recommends that the C-section rate hover between 10 to 15% for all deliveries. But in this country, our C-section rate is at 33%, which is triple to double the recommended rate. In comparison, in 1965, only 4% of births were via C-section. And remember, C-sections are major abdominal surgery. They can be risky to the mother and the baby alike. Mothers run the risk of post-op infection, blood loss, extended healing time, and hospital stays. Babies can have breathing issues since they're not coming down the birth canal. They can have reactions to anesthesia and, in some cases, major injury due to the C-section. But to be sure, there are definitely cases where women need C-sections. But the question is, does a woman relinquish her rights and wishes because she's pregnant? Does the life of the fetus trump the life of the woman? You would be shocked to find out how many women in trying to have natural unassisted births have been arrested while in labor and required to deliver their babies via forced C-section under threat of prosecution or removal of their children from the home. In one case recently, this was in Staten Island, Renat Dre was pressured by the attending physician to submit to a C-section due to having had two previous C-sections. She was threatened with the removal of the baby if she did not submit, even though she already had two children at home. The doctor noted in her chart that he was overriding her wishes, and she's presently suing the doctor and the hospital for malpractice. In another case, a cancer patient, Angela Carter, she decided, with the support of her doctors, to undergo a C-section at 28 weeks. She needed chemo, as she had cancer, but didn't want to harm the baby. Shortly thereafter, the hospital began to question the rights of the fetus, and this is when a judge came into the picture, and then an attorney was also appointed to represent the fetus. The judge found in favor of the fetus and ordered an immediate C-section at 25 weeks. Angela's doctors refused to do the procedure, citing that it was too risky at that point for both the baby and the mom. Another doctor stepped in, did the procedure, and unfortunately the baby died about 2 hours after the C-section, and Angela passed away 2 days later. So unfortunately, this is happening in America, and it's happening every day. So if you don't think that abortion laws don't, if you think that abortion laws don't affect you, I'm betting that none of the women arrested for home birthing or refusing a C-section thought they would either. What we don't talk about and discuss in the abortion debate are the laws and policies that already affect and harm pregnant women who want to carry to term. And this is an area that definitely deserves more attention. What it comes down to is this. These anti-choice laws are punishing women who wish to have abortions, but they are also punitive towards women who wish to continue their pregnancies. This is not just about abortion. Abortion is just the convenient wedge issue. This is about women's ability with each and every pregnancy to decide what is best for them and what is in their hearts. No legislative body, no governor, nor judge can dictate what is in a woman's heart. When we begin to honor the power that women have in regard to each and every pregnancy, we will then see healthier families and communities. So in closing, I want to ask you this. How many of you have kids or want to have kids? How many of you have nieces or nephews? If pregnancy and children are any part of your present or future, these laws affect you, and they could mean the difference between life and death. The question is, can you be trusted with these decisions? Can your sister, your girlfriend, your mother? Who can be trusted? Do women have the right to decision-making during all phases of pregnancy? Or do women relinquish these rights when they become pregnant? For me, the answer is simple. Yes, you deserve trust. Yes, you're the best person to be making these choices for yourself and for your family. And you know what is in your heart. Thank you.
Listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI, we're listening to Julie Burkhart talking about reproductive rights for women. We owe you a few messages. Let's take a break. We'll be right back with the questions and answers from the audience. You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI.
Hey, I'm Nick Spitzer, host of American Roots. Each week, we bring you music and artist interviews from across the American soundscape. Blues and jazz, old-time country and gospel, roots rock and soul, Zydeco, Tejano, and beyond. Join me on the journey on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Wednesday nights from 7:30 to 9:30, right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI.
I am Tony Allard, transgenic artist, currently working with William S. Burroughs DNA Code. Join me for a world mix event on From Arc to Microchip, Radical Radio for Radical Ears.
Wednesday night at 11:30, right after chamber music.
A legal analysis of the Ferguson grand jury on Sprouts, Thursday at noon.
Have a little spare time? Always wanted to be in radio? Well, then come on down and get involved in your community radio station, 90.1 FM, KKFI. On the air or behind the scenes, we need your help, and it's lots of fun, too. For more information, call Bill at the KKFI offices at 816-994-7869.
Longtime radical labor lawyer Tom Gagin wants to chuck the model of unions we've had since World War II and transform the labor laws in the Democratic Party. His new book is called Only One Thing Can Save Us, Why America Needs a New Kind of Labor Movement. We'll interview him this week on the Heartland Labor Forum, then we'll take a look at a group of workers who are organizing. Retail workers. All that Thursday, 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Beginning to understand what was in the heart of every single person who might become engaged, I had to listen to that. I couldn't just say, come help the poor. I had to say, come help yourself.
I'm Neil Harvey. Please join us this week for Don't Mourn, Organize, Power and Passion for Environmental Justice and Democracy on The Bioneers.
Friday mornings at 9:30, right after Between the Lines.
This week on Music City Roots, live from the factory, a roots pop first half and a decidedly country second half, as we ease from the insightful and worldly music of Kai Welch into the stunning honesty and spare beauty of 2014 breakout songwriting star Doug Seegers.
Let me be the one who's got to learn how to forgive, because he doesn't want to lose his road to glory. Let me be the one who cries like a baby when you finally see the light.
Also on the bill, atmospheric Seattle rocker James Apollo and a new Nashville bluegrass supergroup. Missy Raines, Mike Compton, David Greer, and Chad Cobb are the Hell and High Water String Band. So if the creek don't rise, I hope you'll join us for the real deal on Music City Roots.
Saturday morning at 7, right before the Blues Kitchen.
Making a joyful noise when I... Tune in on Saturday afternoons for real local talk radio community programming starting at 3 o'clock p.m. Every Woman with Sharon Lockhart and Amy Bell. 4 o'clock p.m. Urban Connections with Donna Morrow Wolf. 5 o'clock p.m. Guess Who's Coming to Kansas City with MC Richardson.
Venkat Manda returns with more Indian culture and music on Global Roots Radio, Sunday afternoon from 3 to 5 p.m.
Thank you first for being here, and I have 23 questions so far. Seriously, what I'd like to hear you address is in the protection of the fetus, you mentioned the incarceration of the mother. We often hear of what if the mother is drug abusing, what if the mother is doing something that directly, we might say, irresponsibly endangers. If you could address that argument and that issue, please. Thank you.
In a number of these cases, it's women who are lower on the socioeconomic scale, who might have a history of mental health issues such as depression, who might be self-medicating with drugs, alcohol. And so there are definitely those cases. But, you know, these are the women who might have that in their history, but who also want, you know, to be mothers, which also then opens up a whole other can of worms, you know, who is to be a mother and not. These are exactly the women who need that representation and need to make sure that they have equitable treatment. But then there are also other cases of women who simply are going against the grain when it comes to the medical profession and wanting to do home birthing or really wanting to have vaginal delivery after a previous C-section. So it's definitely a mix of different types of women who are prosecuted and jailed at times.
Yeah, I've got a couple of them, but I'll do the one that's probably going to take the longer answer first. I was dismayed to learn from different people that I've had contact with over the last few years that it seems that physicians, OB-GYN doctors, are not doing tubal ligations on women later and later and later without regard to how many children they already have. The specific gal I talked to said she had had 5 abortions and had 5 children. And she just apparently a lot of the methods of birth control she tried just did not work. You know, it just, she had tried a number of different kinds. And the physician would not give her a tubal ligation until she was 21 years old. And yes, this means she was sexually active young, which, you know, in our culture is frowned upon. But, you know, she was ready to have a tubal ligation when she was 18. And now she has a daughter who has similar problems with birth control methods, and the doctor doesn't want to give her a tubal ligation until she's 25. And I'm like, excuse me? You know? Anyway, I was wondering if you would comment on that, if you'd seen that trend and what's backing it. I mean, I understand the trend towards C-sections is basically trying to prevent litigation, you know, against the doctors for problems in the delivery. But why this deal with putting off tubal ligations, I don't understand.
Well, we also run into this when it comes to IUD use for younger women. And I think that the school of thought is changing, but not fully. So, you know, it used to be thought that, you know, if you're a woman and you're young and you think that you don't want children, then your opinion was discounted because of your age. I think that that's changing now. And also, if the woman was receiving treatment from a Catholic facility, you know, a woman's not going to get a tubal ligation there. So not knowing, you know, who the physician was affiliated with, And then I think this also speaks to a broader problem as well. If she was 21, had five children already? Yeah, so this speaks to, you know, inadequate sex ed and access to contraceptives. You know, what we find is that the people who lack financial resources and who want to contracept are not able to access those contraceptives, so therefore they have more children, more abortions, and it's just an ongoing cycle. So it's something that I know is with newer physicians, younger physicians who are coming into practice, and all of our physicians except one are in their 30s and 40s now. The mindset is a little different, that women at any age have the right to sterilization or IUD use. And we're really big advocates of IUDs. I can't tell you how many IUDs we place every week for young women and older women as well.
Yes. How many clinics are there that are licensed or legal or whatever to perform abortions in Missouri and Kansas? And if you know of Arkansas, I'd be interested. Mm-hmm. And what hours, not hours, but what days are they open? What's their availability? I know it's gone down to trickle.
Well, interesting. I was just in Little Rock this last week. So there is one clinic in Little Rock. There's also a clinic in Fayetteville that offers medication abortion. So I believe they go to 10 weeks, but Little Rock 21.6, so early second trimester. And then in Missouri, there's, you know, one clinic in St. Louis. You know, the laws in Missouri are just quite prohibitive and and have caused providers to close due to the structural requirements, you know, placed on owners and providers. So one clinic in Missouri, and then, of course, there are two providers here in the Kansas City area, and then us in Wichita, and that's it. And there are two providers in Oklahoma. So in this region where you have, you know, several million people, it's definitely an underserved region.
You alluded to this in earlier discussion, but I'd like to ask you, what do you think the role of sex education plays in this? I know that I was living in Georgia when the mm-hmm. abstinence-only movement came very high. Right. Within 5 years, Georgia's out of wedlock and unintended pregnancy rate skyrocketed.
Well, and that's the thing, that we have a lot of discomfort in this country talking about sex, and it would serve our young people well if we could have an open, honest discussion about sexuality. We're just hardwired that way, and the constant denial of that is just mind-blowing to me. You know, and so, you know, we have sex educators who have been pushed out of the public schools. Certain sex educators cannot be in public schools. And then with, you know, the government taking more money from the abstinence-only groups, we are, you know, just doing our young people a disservice. And then not having access to contraceptives, that's another piece of this puzzle.
Going back to the very first question that was asked this morning, is it possible to craft a law which would be able to distinguish in complexity of the issue relating to the rights of a fetus versus the rights of a woman in terms of a woman who may be abusing drugs or doing other behaviors that may endanger the fetus? Do you understand what I'm asking? In other words, can we craft a law that would balance the rights of the mother with endangerment of a fetus?
Honestly, in this political climate, I don't think that's possible. I don't believe that we would make any positive headway. And I guess maybe I don't. So when you're looking at, you know, the rights of the woman versus the rights of the fetus, is that at all phases of pregnancy? So are we looking at pre-viability, post-viability? And then what is it exactly that the woman would be doing or not doing to in order to, what, be forced to into long-term treatment or incarceration? So I think there are varying... there are a lot of questions that would have to be answered there. What, you know, we have seen, you know, in a lot of these examples where pregnant women have been incarcerated or been charged with child endangerment or fetal homicide, is women going to their health care providers for care and disclosing to their providers their situation and being honest about recreational drug use or their you know, state of mental health, and finding that those health professionals are then using the laws that are in place, the, you know, fetal personhood like laws, to use then against the pregnant women. So I don't, I'm not optimistic that something like that could be crafted, and I would worry about the woman having adequate representation in that.
I felt a slight edge of concern when you were talking about trusting the views of the woman entirely. With respect to having a C-section or not, because there are certainly cases, and indeed we had one connected with our own family, in which a C-section should have been done sooner and wasn't, and the infant was born with some brain damage. And so there may be times when the physician's recommendation should prevail. Could you reflect on that again?
Well, the, you know, the cases that I referenced was, you know, a woman who had decided with her physician to delay the C-section because she needed the chemotherapy and was concerned about the life and the health of her baby. And then the other woman who, you know, could not find a physician to let her try a VBAC. I mean, there are always, you know, no case is going to fit perfectly in, you know, one column or another. But I think, you know, being more mindful about what the woman and her family might want during the birthing process versus what is, you know, medical convention at that time, and being able to allow the woman some latitude in being able to have a part of that decision making, but no case is certainly always going to be perfect.
My second question is: has anybody successfully argued that all these personhood definitions constitute a challenge to church and state, that these definitions of personhood reflect a more of a theological stance than a scientific and medical stance? That is a concern of mine, that I feel like the, many of the these definitions of personhood reflect the theology of certain long-standing denominations.
Not to my knowledge. You know, typically the arguments are in opposition to these bills or initiatives. It's that it would prohibit in vitro fertilization, certain types of contraceptives, and abortion. I've never heard that argument.
I have a question that I would like to ask. As I said, you know, things were running through my head of memories of my own situation at many times. What is the situation in terms of when consent from another party is involved? At the time, again, when I first looked for things, you were required to have a written consent from your husband. And young women were expected to have some kind of consent from their parents. What are generally the rules now about cases when consent is required?
Well, presently, no one else has to consent if a woman is seeking an abortion, except in some states there are single, dual parental consent laws. There's a rather stringent law being challenged right now in Alabama, which would allow it's in regards to minors seeking abortion care. The male involved would be able to come and testify in front of the court, as well as relatives of the minor, if she was seeking an abortion. And I don't know about sterilization. If it's certainly not anything that we require at our clinic. Well, and I certainly advocate for that. That's where I got my sex ed, and I think it's served me well throughout my life.
It's a discouraging political debate that's been going on for about 40 or 50 years, and I find it really hard to get into the mind of people who have such a mania for this issue on the anti-abortion side. You've obviously been in a lot of these debates. What's the current state of their thinking, and give us, if you can, one positive story about someone changing their mind, and how do you get into their mind and make them realize that trusting women makes sense and these extreme positions maybe aren't so sensible? Is that argument winnable?
Well, not to sound jaded, I don't believe it is, but and that's why I think it's so important that we respect people's differences, different approaches that we have to our lives and our families and what comprises that. I can't, unfortunately, give you any instances of somebody changing their mind. I think that when I talk with people who are, anti-choice, just really trying to talk with people, having an open mind, speaking truth, just, trying to understand where they're coming from. But I feel that people, especially now in our country, we're so entrenched. It's you're either a Democrat or a Republican. You're liberal or conservative. There's not a lot of middle ground anymore. So what we ask is, and what we tell people in the community who are anti-choice, it's, we provide abortion. We provide a lot of other things, too, which I haven't even talked about. But that's, the one thing that we provide that some people are adamantly opposed to. But we ask that people, respect us as a medical provider, respect the women who are coming in to access these services, because they're just trying to make the best possible decisions. So I don't know how to answer that otherwise.
I have a question that's kind of on the other side. I personally have never been pregnant, but I've dealt with different contraceptives, including IUDs in the morning after pill, and I've always been very steadfast that, yes, if I ever were to become pregnant in this time of my life, I would get an abortion, but I've also thought, this is me on this side of the fence, then I could get pregnant and something could change. But I guess part of my stance in that, a lot of it has to do with economic as well as just being too young to know that I can't give myself to a child in the way that I should be able to have a child. I was discussing with my friends the other day, seeing women who seem to be in a position worse off than me, not only economically, but just, all the factors that come into play when you are ready to bring a child in the world. Do you have any, we were just wondering, non-judgmental way, what makes them decide, yes, I am going to go through and have this child you know, is it like the hormones? Is it, you know, I guess, do you have any insight into that?
If a woman, in continuing her pregnancy?
Right, in a situation that doesn't seem favorable to mm-hmm. have. Someone who's young, doesn't have a lot mm-hmm. of money, support systems are low, sort of thing.
Right. Well, so I think there are, you know, a few factors. You know, one is, you know, a woman, and a young woman in this case, maybe, you know, she might, whether she has enough money or not, or has the education she wants or not, you know, maybe when she becomes pregnant, she just really wants to be a mom. So that could be part of it. It could be, you know, what she has been taught and told within her family, that what is right and what is wrong, and she doesn't want to disappoint her mother or father or partner. You know, abortion is also very stigmatized. You know, I feel like it's even more stigmatized than it was when I started working at a clinic back in the 80s. And so women, you know, deciding to walk through that door, that's, you know, potentially a piece of it. So it's just, it's you know, hard to say without asking each and every person. But, you know, so that's the thing, is that, you know, women, you know, decide to have abortions because, you know, maybe they don't make enough money. Maybe they want to continue their education. Maybe they already have a couple of children and don't feel like they can handle any more children. And women are often told that they're, you know, selfish for making this decision for those reasons. But I really disagree with that, in that it's all a matter of what a woman feels like she can handle and have on her shoulders at that time.
Well, I guess something I learned recently, I do have a friend that recently had an abortion, and she caught it very early, so she just had to do the pill, mm-hmm. and that was $700. And I know I live paycheck to paycheck, and I'm sure a lot of people do, and who have $700 up front is incredibly difficult, and it's not something you can really crowdsource your family for. So, I mean, unless you have a very understanding relative who also makes a good amount of money, I just was really blown away by that. You know, because it was just a pill, it wasn't even like a medical procedure. I don't, yeah.
Yeah, well, okay, so we have in a number of states, and, you know, this area's insurance does not cover abortion care. So, you know, we can't, even if a woman walks in our doors, she has her own insurance, we cannot bill for any part of the abortion because there are laws against that. So that is, you know, puts a woman in a bind. You know, and so this is the, you know, there are funds. There are a lot of funds across the country. We work with a number of them to help women who just can't come up with the full amount. So this is like a very sticky area because, one, you know, providers are providing a medical service, but this is a social justice, reproductive justice issue. And so trying to reconcile those at times can be difficult.
I wanted to talk about the issue with women who are drug addicted and are pregnant, or the question about the cesarean and the trusting women under those conditions. And I don't know if the conversation has gone here, but it seems to me that there's this assumption now that we can control all aspects of pregnancy and birth and make them perfect, because there are so many fewer losses, there's so many fewer issues with birth now, with nutrition and healthcare and clean water and all of those types of things. And so if something goes wrong, somebody must be blamed. And the research seems to tell us that actual drug use during pregnancy has much less of an effect on infants than we think, that, you know, birth, whether a cesarean is performed or not, has much less of an impact on the safety of the fetus as we think, but we use it as the excuse for everything. Is that something that you see playing into these laws and the arguments that are coming up?
Yes, I do. And I feel that, you know, women are you know, women ultimately take the brunt of the responsibility for this, because we are told that, you know, we have to do everything perfectly. If we don't do everything perfectly, then, you know, it's our fault. And so then what we're seeing is laws that work to, you know, legislate, regulate our bodies.
Thank you for being here. Would you please list some of the other services that your facility offers?
Sure. Let's see. We do family planning care. We offer Eshore, which is a type of sterilization. We offer general GYN care. I won't read it all. We do transgender care and serve the broader LGBTQIA community. So those are some of the things. I'm hoping at one point we will add on a birthing center, but we haven't gotten there. So at this time, we offer early prenatal care.
Thank you very much for being here, Julie. Yeah.
You've been listening to a talk entitled Worth of a Woman by Julie Burkhart. This program was recorded on Sunday, December the 14th at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. This program is produced and edited for broadcast each week by Barry Lee. Thank you to Rita Norton and the staff at All Souls who provide us the recordings and the facilities for the forum. The music you're hearing in the background is composed and played by local artist Fred Potter. Tune in again next week for another All Souls Forum at this same time and place. We're also available via podcast on KKFI's website at www.kkfi.org. You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.